Welcome to another Two Rivers Tribune KIDE special interview. Our host is Dr. Joshua Strange.
Today we're going to be speaking with Dr. Dick Jackson of UCLA. He's with the Environmental Health Sciences, and he's a professor at the Institute of Environment and Sustainability in Urban Planning. So welcome to the show today, and my understanding is that you started out as a medical doctor, a pediatrician, and now you have a book coming out called Designing Healthy Communities. And I just wanted to open up by asking, how did that journey occur, going from a doctor to focusing on design and urban planning?
Well, you know, I trained at the University of California, San Francisco, but I grew up in New Jersey. And when you grow up in New Jersey, you understand from a very young age that environment really impacts health. I'm sure Native American people understand the positive aspects of the environment and its impact on well-being, but poor New Jersey was very much savaged by a lot of pollution, a lot of industry. It's come around quite a bit over the last 35 years. Right. I was lucky enough to go to UCSF in San Francisco for med school and wanted to work on pesticide and pesticide health effects. And after my pediatric residency, began to study clusters of birth defects, cancer, and environmental issues. In fact, my first encounters with the population up north and in the Trinity Alps and the Shasta area was the concern about 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T herbicide spraying. Over time, I got to be friends with the Shasta health officer and have spent a fair amount of time in northwestern California. It's a terrific area. I also became convinced over time that we've underattended to the importance of environment to people's well-being. By underattended, I mean we focus on taking care of people that are already sick, but we don't pay enough attention to preventing disease, including diseases that are the effect of the environments we're living in.
Yeah, one of the things you really talk about in the book as a thesis really is that maintaining good physical health isn't just about our personal choices, it's about the system and how it's designed and how our built environment is designed. And of course, that affects a lot more than just our physical health, but also our mental health. And I was wondering if you could share with us, what are some of the consequences, health consequences, of the way our modern built environment has been designed and conducted?
You know, when I was a young pediatrician, I'd work in the diabetes clinic. We would see almost all the children had what we called insulin-dependent diabetes, juvenile diabetes. Now, more than half the kids in the clinic have type 2 diabetes, what we now call, back then we called it adult-onset diabetes, now right. We call it type 2. And in large part, it's the result of obesity. We've seen a tripling and a quadrupling of obesity in our school-age and teenage children in the United States. And obesity is a huge risk factor for a whole series of diseases, high blood pressure, stroke, joint problems, liver disease. But it's a big risk for people, including children, to become diabetic. So more and more we're seeing diseases of middle age, late middle age in our children. And it's being driven in two ways. One, by the change in the American diet, too much processed food, too much fat, too much sugar, too much salt. And also by removing physical activity, exercise, from people's lives. And when people think of exercise, they think of, you know, going to the gym and doing something repetitive on a machine. But in the truth, our parents, our grandparents, their exercise was going about their daily lives, their incidental activities, whether it was perhaps at a native people, it was long walks and hiking and fishing even hunting. But now most of us get our food at a market, and most of it's processed.
Right. Yeah. In fact, around here, I think the folks were pretty well known for their stamina and their ability to, you know, chase after game and whatnot. And of course, nowadays, Hoopa, like other communities, is struggling with obesity and type 2 diabetes and a lot of screen time for kids. So that does seem to be a consequence of how things are designed and some of the isolation that occurs in our modern environments. And why is it that there is so much isolation occurring, and what kind of problems spin off from that isolation?
Well, you know, everyone knows you are what you eat, but I would argue that we are what we build. And over time, we've built bigger and bigger homes for smaller and smaller families over the last two generations. Many Americans spend more time in their car than they spend with their spouse, at least when waking hours. Many children spend more time watching a television screen, far more time than outdoors and being engaged with other kids. So our socialization has gone down as the amount of commuting and amount of time we spend alone in vehicles has gone up. At the same time, our obesity rates have gone up and lack of fitness has gone up. The average person living in a sprawling area, very car-dependent area, weighs about 7 pounds more than a person that's living in a walkable area. And what's interesting, particularly as you were talking about folks, you know, out of heredity, lived in environments where food was often very abundant for a while and very short supply, and there was a real survival value to be able to pack on the calories for the bad times that might be coming. That survival value doesn't work very well when we don't need to be carrying all those calories all the time that we end up doing, and all Americans are doing this.
Right, and that's also something that is exploited by the food processing industry, is using things like fats and sugars to get us to buy their products, eat their products. And it's really tricking the taste buds that evolved in a, you know, sort of a feast and famine environment when there was an incentive to eat rich, high-calorie foods when the opportunity arises. So it's kind of using that or a past against us, if you will.
You know, nature puts fructose in various foods because, you know, she wants us to eat fruit and spread the seeds around the forest, or wants animals to do that. And fructose tastes great, but nature only gave us very small bits of it at a time. Mother Nature never intended that we would be drinking a 20-ounce or a 32-ounce soft drink with as many as 20, 30 grams or large amounts of sugar in it at the same time. And most of that sugar, the majority of it being fructose, our livers, our bodies are not designed for that. You know, we can live in environments that are very hot and do lots of physical work, and we can handle a fair amount of salt and a fair amount of fat, which has lots of calories if we're sweating a lot. But if we're not in that environment, it's really lethal.
Right, right. One of the statistics that you cited that really struck me was that in 1974, about 66% of kids walked or biked to school each day. And by comparison, in 2000, that figure was down to 13%. And obviously, you know, that represents a decline in some physical activity. But one of the barriers that you talk about is that a lot of our built environments now are just not friendly to, say, walking or biking. And that may be because, you know, you have a near lethal experience trying to cross a bridge with no bike lanes, or maybe it's because, you know, they're spraying 2,4-D pesticides on the side of the road that you're trying to walk along, and things of that nature. And I'm just wondering how much, you know, what are the trends that you see happening in terms of trying to reverse that and get kids out more and allow more opportunities for people-powered transportation?
Well, you hit the bad news very well. I mean, we got rid of a lot of the small local schools. We reduced the number of schools dramatically after World War II. We made them bigger and bigger and bigger. The costs of getting children back and forth to those schools were borne by either the parents or the school district by paying for school buses. And the capital cost for building a big box school that would handle thousands of students at the same time, you know, the building costs were less than a bunch of smaller schools, but over time those costs count up. The costs count up in other ways, because a child who is overweight or unfit is far more likely, four times more likely, to be overweight, obese, and unfit as an adult. So the patterns we set up early in life stay with us for a long period of time. By the way, a child who walks or bikes to school learns better, behaves better, socializes better than a child who's sitting strapped in the back of a vehicle to go about their daily lives. So I would say, A, anything we do that removes physical activity from a child's life is a loss. And removing exercise in green environments, removing contact with nature, is not just a physical loss. I think it's an emotional and spiritual loss at the same time.
Yeah, I actually commuted to college a fair amount on my bicycle, and that was back when Caltrans was still spraying our roadsides with a really toxic stew of pesticides, including 2,4-D, which is one of the main ingredients in Agent Orange. And that was something that really infuriated me, because I was riding my bicycle because I wanted to stay fit, and I also enjoyed the beauty of riding along on a sunny spring day, you know, watching the scenery, you know, go by. But when you have a big orange strip of dead grass along the road and you know it's really toxic, really puts it into a stressful situation. So I can really see and relate to how those kind of barriers can prevent even determine people from trying to engage in that type of transportation.
You know, something that dismays me or upsets me very much, which is, here's a young person, they want to do what's right. They don't want to burn fossil fuels. They want to exercise. They don't want to create congestion. They're going out of their way to be a good environmental and human neighbor, and we make the lives of pedestrians and bicyclists almost miserable in the United States, and that's the bad news. I think the good news is we've got a fair number of locations and cities, big cities like New York, have worked hard to become they've always been pretty pedestrian-friendly, but much more bicycle-friendly. There's now a bike route that goes all the way around Manhattan. Cities like Portland, Oregon, which has gone from very few bike routes over the last 15 years to the highest prevalence of biking in the country. And smaller cities or university towns like Davis and Boulder, Colorado, where it is normal for people to bicycle from one place to another. It's not seen as an unusual behavior. Isn't that great? I mean, you don't have to pay to join a health club. You can get your exercise, you can save money, and you can arrive with a smile on your face instead of white-knuckled stressed.
Yeah, when I was going to graduate school at the University of Washington in Seattle, I rode my bike every day on the Burke Gilman Trail, which is a bicycle and jogging trail. And it really was pleasant, and like you said, I got my daily exercise, and I actually got to school faster than had I been taking a bus or trying to drive my car. I didn't have to deal with parking or parking tickets, so it really was convenient. But I needed that trail to be there to really give me that option.
Where I am at UCLA, a fair number of the young folks live over in Santa Monica on the other side of the 405 freeway, which is like a giant wall between where people live and getting over to UCLA, and the traffic can stop, and I'm not exaggerating, for 60 to 80 minutes at a time. And
wow.
The young doctors that work the night shift, I'm talking about the interns and residents that have to be start at 5:30, 6 o'clock, a lot of them try and bike over, but it's extremely dangerous, especially getting underneath the 405 on a narrow tunnel on Wilshire Boulevard.
Right.
But they tell me they take their bikes because they can get to the hospital 2 to 3 times more quickly than they can by bus. And yet we make it lives very, very difficult for the people that are doing what we want them and they need to be doing for their health.
Yeah, and one of the things I wanted to talk about was, you know, you talk a lot about urban design and urban issues, but a lot of these do seem to translate into urban areas, and I was wondering what your thoughts are in terms of some of the issues that are pertinent to urban areas as well as rural areas, being that we're out here in Indian Country and on the beautiful Trinity River. What were your thoughts on that?
Multiple thoughts, and I'm not an expert on rural areas. One is that human beings need to walk. They need to have contact with nature. It's part of our physical and emotional and social well-being. Two is EPA has a vision of every river and stream in America being swimmable and fishable. I would like to see every river and stream also be walkable and bikeable, at least along. And we ought to have river parkways near many of the areas. No one thinks twice about putting a roadway or a railroad along a river, but why shouldn't the average family be able to do it? I love seeing what happened to Reading when they put the beautiful Sundial Bridge in. It became a heart for that whole part of the community, and people socialize there. It's been a magnet for additional park areas and social areas at the same time.
Yeah, it's my favorite place in Reading, for sure.
And you know, I'm sure 15 years ago when someone was talking about building that, somebody said, "Oh, that's a waste of money. Nobody will use it." And yet, it's given an identity, a positive and enthusiastic identity, to the community that people have real pride in.
Yeah, and that's something that we're seeing elsewhere. Is a lot of communities kind of that maybe had turned their backs to their waterfronts and had sort of industrial areas that are now in decline are now revitalizing those areas and retrofitting them. So maybe we can talk about some of the success stories that are out there in terms of retrofitting and redevelopment that's going on across the country.
Let me tell you two quick stories, if I may. Probably one of the most sprawling cities, and I was at the Centers for Disease Control for 10 years in Atlanta, Georgia. One of the sprawling cities is Atlanta, and a typical Atlantan spends an hour each way traveling by car, commuting. This is not quality time, by the way. Graduate students at Georgia Tech discovered that there was a leftover train route that encircled downtown Atlanta and proposed the so-called Beltline, which would be a mixture of transit, bicycles, and parks connected to other parks, which would meet the needs for people to have recreation, to have green space, to get from one place to another with a smile on their face, including to transit nodes, retail, schools, and other things. It is now the largest capital program, the re-envisioning of Atlanta with this Beltline in place, and it will give Atlanta, just as the bridge in Reading did, give it a heart that it really needs, because people need to be in places that feel welcoming, that feel comfortable, that you know, cultivate happiness, not just an easy way to get to the supermarket or something else. Another city that's done a beautiful job is Elgin, E-L-G-I-N, in Illinois. A Rust Belt town that was quite depressed for years after the Elgin Watch Company closed in the 1950s, they rediscovered their river, the Fox River. Oftentimes, the early development in a community is right by the river, so a lot of the oldest and most industrial and sometimes most polluting and most pavement and concrete and old buildings are located there.
Right.
It takes a super fun cleanup. You know, you got to get rid of the toxics the debris that's there. A lot of the old buildings have a lot of character, and be able to redevelop those into condos or restaurants or places that people want to be, putting in some parkland. What Elgin did was not only put in some parkland, but some pavilions, a band shell. People are actually getting married at marriage ceremonies at what used to be an old industrial and Superfund site, because it's now, you know, with a fountain and other kinds of things that attract people to want to be there, a place of the heart rather than a place of misery.
Wow, that's really impressive. Yeah, the first time I encountered these types of design principles in action was actually in Christchurch, New Zealand. Usually when I'm in cities, I'm trying to think of how I can kind of get it back out to the countryside as fast as possible. But they have several really nice elements there. One is they have some networks of downtown streets that are permanently closed to traffic. And it basically makes for like a plaza-type atmosphere where people are walking around, shopping. And then, of course, there's also a small river that runs through the downtown. And rather than bury it and put it into culverts and such, it's actually a green corridor with a park on either side. And it winds right through the skyscrapers. And it was amazing. I was sitting there watching people, you know, their suits and ties on lunch. And one of the things that I really noticed was how quiet it was. I could hear the wind rustling in the trees. I could hear the water. There was rowboats going by. There was ducks quacking. And it was very relaxing because of that, in comparison to the hustle and bustle of your average busy downtown. And that was really striking when I experienced that.
You know, I'm an urbanite, I admit it. And I like hustle and bustle. I like people walking around. I like to listen to a mariachi band. I like to see people sitting in cafes and talking to each other, older folks perhaps playing chess or simply having a conversation in a pleasant, attractive place. And yet we've forgotten those are the things that make us happy. And the purpose of transportation is to get people from one place to another and to get people help people meet their needs. And somehow we forgot that that was the purpose. And the transportation engineers decided, oh, the purpose is to move as many cars as you can, as quickly as you can. And no, that's not why we put in transportation systems. It's for people, not for cars, not for vehicles. And I think really this is the larger message, is we've somehow 60, 80 years ago decided the car was the most important thing and human beings didn't matter. In the 21st century, we need to rediscover what matters.
And I think one of the quotes I heard you say, that with the problems facing us today with the built environment, it's actually a tremendous opportunity. You know, it's a tremendous opportunity to say, okay, how can we do this better? How can we design our communities and our cities for health? And I think along with that, I would add that the issue with global oil supplies, you know, where the easy oil is mostly gone, it's getting harder and harder to get. It's contributing to climate change and a whole host of problems. And again, that points back towards car and a car culture. So it seems like it's also a tremendous opportunity to shift into alternative fuels, alternative transportations, and also do it in a way that is part of a human-centered, human-designed infrastructure and communities.
You know, I really had fun working on the public broadcasting series. We visited 14 cities, and one of my favorites was Charleston, South Carolina. And the mayor of Charleston, Joe Riley, came into his job about 30-plus years ago. And what they wanted to do was tear down all the old wooden three-story buildings that had a lot of personality looking out over the bay there in Charleston, and put up high-rises everywhere, make it look exactly like everywhere else. And Joe Riley said,
right,
no, I'm going to make this a place that people want to be. And he stopped the bulldozers. He would not let them take it down. He insisted that the downtown be rehabilitated, would not allow the high-rises right next to the water. And when I interviewed him, he had a wonderful quotation. He said, we need to build places that are just as good as anywhere anyone would want to go for vacation. In other words, our destinations ought to be where we live, not necessarily someplace far away that we have to pay a lot of money to go to.
Yeah, and I guess if you have, you know, people getting married in those types of places, it's an indication that it's been successful in making it a beautiful destination, even if it is close to home.
You know, and what's shocking is, and I really mean this, it's not much more expensive to do it right. It takes vision, and it takes community engagement. And maybe this is a big message for the listeners, which is a lot of the best plans were not done by some architect, planner, or for that matter, doctor that came in from far away. It was the community dialogue where people got together and said, you know, we really want a place that our kids can be comfortable and can play and enjoy their lives. We want to have a place that if you're old, you don't have to get in a car to meet every single need. If you're a teenager, you can meet up with other kids in a safe setting that is embedded in the community and not isolated from the community. We want a place that has water. We want a place with some music. We want a place with food and restaurants. We want a place with a farmer's market. Over and over again, people tell you those messages, and yet we pretend we're going to create that by creating subdivisions with the names of trees and creating malls with the names of some place in Europe rather than places that really fit with the local vernacular, the landscape, the feeling of the place.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that's something you talk about in your book too, that sometimes designers and planners are really designing stuff based on their ideals and from a designer's point of view, and maybe even how good it looks on paper or modeled out, as opposed to how does it actually work for the community that it's supposed to serve, and what are the needs of that community, and you know, let the community drive what the design should look like in terms of its functionality, and then the designers can come in and help provide the expertise so that to maximize its success.
When I was in Sacramento, I was state health officer for a year and a half, in about 2004 and 5. And the little house that I had a pretty big vacant lot nearby, and it was being proposed for redevelopment. And the designers flew down from Seattle, and they laid out this plan. And the neighborhood were these really nice 2, 3, 4-story homes that had looked like old Sacramento back, you know, they really had personality, mm-hmm. and the nice big trees. And the designer came in, he laid out something that looked like some minimalist thing from Bilbao in Spain. I mean, it didn't fit the community at all. And I said to him, you know, this doesn't fit this community. It looks completely different from everything else here. And he said, oh, you just want me to be derivative. And I said, no, I just want you to create something that's not hideous.
Yeah, something that functions for where it's supposed to be and fits into the setting.
Yeah, and it should be different enough to have personality, but not so different that it feels like it never belonged there. In fact, the places we like best usually have local materials. The beautiful orange roofs, tile roofs that we think of as old California, they weren't put there because of design reasons. They were put there because it was the local clay that was used to make the tiles.
Right, and here in Hoopa, too, you know, we have a downtown area, but really your choices are to either go hang out at the gas station or by the tree or over at the supermarket, and that's something we really need, some smart development that meets the community's needs, but could also incorporate some of the local flavor, some of the architecture, the traditional juntas, the cedar plank houses, and things of that nature that would give not only more utility to the downtown area, but more pride in the community, too, because one of the things that you talk about is that part of our mental health is the need for social connection, a need for safety, and a need for beauty as well.
You know, I had the good luck of visiting the Potawatomi Indian I don't think that's the right name, the medical center. Humboldt del Norte, and the community was very involved in designing that clinic and healthcare setting with the healing gardens and nearby organic gardens and the sweat houses. And there was so much pride in the people there. This was really a heart for the community, and I loved it because it was, in my mind, a real health center rather than a disease care center.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you, Dr. Jackson, not only for this conversation today, but for all of your service to humanity. And I think that you really have been at the forefront of putting these ideas out there into the mainstream, and particularly with your the TV series on PBS, and that is ongoing, correct?
It is ongoing, and agitate to get to your local PBS station to show it if it has only been shown at some odd time.
Right, right. And what is the title of that series again?
Designing Healthy Communities, and it's 4 hours, and it's being shown right now in Chicago, and we'll be shown in the next week or two in Philadelphia. And it's gotten quite, people enjoy it. They think, oh, I'll watch 15 minutes, and they end up watching several hours.
Yeah, well, there's nothing that can stop an idea whose time has come. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
This has been a special production of the Two Rivers Tribune and KIDE Hoopa Tribal Radio. My guest was Dr. Dick Jackson of UCLA, and I'm Dr. Joshua Strange.
You have been listening to a Two Rivers Tribune KIDE special interview hosted by Dr. Joshua Strange, engineered by Joseph Orozco, recorded at the KIDE Studios, Hoopa, California. Thank you for listening.